Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, going to be your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Looking forward to a really wonderful collection of guests this afternoon. Jean Moe is going to be in town on Monday, talking at the State Historical Library about her new book, which is about the a bunch of travelers' tales recorded between 1879 and 1909. So we'll talk to her, and then we'll also have the chief curator, Bob Banghart of the Alaska State Museum, talking about the changes, the buildings that are going up right across the way from K2. Safran Hayes will come in to highlight the premiere of a new film documenting his travels in Alaska, Nepal, and India, and we'll talk with the musicians and food folks that are participating in this weekend's Food Truck Friday and Music on the Fly. All that will be on Juneau Afternoon today, so stay tuned. National Native News is next.
This is National. Hey, Katie, what's... This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. 6 South Dakota tribes are forming a multi-tribal power authority to build large-scale wind farms. Tribal leaders recently joined former President Bill Clinton and others like former U.S. North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan to announce plans. Victoria Wicks reports.
The 6 tribes are receiving assistance from Clinton's Global Initiative, the Bush Foundation, the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, and other agencies. Byron Dorgan is senior policy advisor with one of the assisting firms, Arendt Fox. He has been doing pro bono work on the project for a couple of years.
These Indian tribes in many cases have been put off on land far from cities and land without a lot of, you know, natural attributes, minerals and so on. But the fact is the wind blows, and it's the Saudi Arabia of wind in our whole region, and they have the opportunity to harvest energy from the wind and sell it to a country that needs energy, and they would have a stream of income for 30 or 40 years as a result of that, in addition to providing low-cost power to their own reservations.
Dorgan says it will take a couple more years to create the legal authority and complete wind and transmission studies. Construction is to be funded by bonds guaranteed by purchase agreements for the energy, which Dorgan says could be as much as a gigawatt or 1,000 megawatts. Tribes participating are Cheyenne River, Crow Creek, Oglala, Rosebud, Sisseton, Wahpeton, and Yankton. President Cyril Scott from Rosebud says it was a great day when he stood on stage with Dorgan, Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton, among others.
Indian country is ready to go. We're hoping in the next 2 years to have the foundation set in place and the finances in place to start this.
Scott says tribes want to start their own electrical cooperatives and use the revenue for greater self-sufficiency. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
An Alaska Native Tribal Council has entered into a partnership with an East Coast game developer to create a Native-owned video game company. KSKT's Shady Grove Oliver reports.
The Cook Inlet Tribal Council, based in South Central Alaska, is working with Eline Media, a New York-based game developer. Together, they've established Upper One Games. As the company's website boasts, in Alaska, our goals are higher, our voice louder, and our spirit stronger. It plans to release games based on Alaska Native stories. The first game will follow the life of a young Inupiaq girl who uses her wits and courage to survive in the far north. Gloria O'Neill is the Tribal Council President and CEO of Upper One. She says the council was looking for a business venture that would spark the interest of all youth, both Alaskan Native and not.
We are in a digital world now, and our young people, they've grown up around technology.
Through video games, the Tribal Council hopes to promote pride in culture and create a forum for cross-cultural education and understanding. The company says its first game should be released by fall of 2014. I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says an executive order issued this week establishes a council to better engage the federal government with tribes. In a speech Thursday to tribal leaders in Reno, Nevada, Jewell made a pledge to uphold trust responsibilities. She's been on the job for more than 2 months and in a press call says consultation will be an important part of the council.
I didn't really fully understand the concept of self-determination and self-governance and how it interfaces with the federal government. And I would expect that many of my colleagues on the cabinet will also not be as steeped in those issues. This council will bring all of us together to understand that more deeply.
Jewell will chair the council, which includes a number of other federal departments and offices.
Yeah.
During this week in 1990, Petroglyph National Monument was established in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to protect petroglyphs featuring images carved onto rocks by indigenous people hundreds of years ago. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2014, with applications accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. My first guest today is Gene Moe, and Gene is going to be doing a presentation at the Historical Library here in Juneau. I believe it's, is that tomorrow afternoon?
It's actually Monday.
Monday afternoon, okay.
Right.
And Gene has written a really interesting a book that has an interesting limitation to its time span. The book is called In Pursuit of Alaska, an anthology of travelers' tales from 1879 to 1909. And I guess the first question I wanted to ask you is, how come it's limited to just those years?
Well, actually what happened, Pat, is that the writers that I was reading sort of dictated those limitations. When I started looking at the old books in the UAA library, the period that I found the most enchanting was the very period we're talking about. That 30 years of Alaska history was so significant, and there was so much of importance that happened, and the writers that I happened to like the best had all come north during that time. So the writers really did dictate the time period.
Well, in terms of Juneau history, 1879, of course, is the year that John Lemon was finding gold in here on Lemon Creek, out in the middle of our Lemon Creek Valley.
Right.
And 1909, by then, we, at least in southeast Alaska, were deeply involved in the production of gold here.
Right.
And the rest of Alaska was, during that period, starting to come to the fore, but not a lot of people knew much about interior Alaska until the gold rush to Fairbanks and the gold rush to Nome.
That's correct.
So you were able to find authors who told about that period of time.
Yeah, and what happened is that, as you undoubtedly know, until John Muir came in 1879 to study the glaciers and stayed to hike around the wilderness, most Americans still thought of Alaska as this frozen land of ice and snow. And Muir wrote some of the first widely read firsthand accounts of Alaska, was sending back on the monthly mailboat these dispatches that were published in San Francisco and then on demand around the rest of the country. And that's what gave the commercial tour operators to start the tours. So you're entirely correct that in that first decade, Juneau had started growing and the southern towns were known. The tourists started coming to visit the southeastern panhandle, but the interior was still largely unmapped. The Russians had settled along the coastline. Their main interest were the maritime animals, and they didn't get into the interior a whole lot. At the height of the Russian occupation, there were only 835, it's estimated, of them in the territory. And so they never really got very far away from the coast. They tried to get up the Copper River and didn't have any success doing that. So by and large, the interior was still unmapped. General named Nelson Miles wanted to find out what the interior was like and started sending people north. He was responsible for Fred Schlotka doing the Yukon in 1883 and then sent William Abercrombie back to try to get up the Copper River in 1884. Abercrombie failed, but the next year Henry Allen managed to do it and managed to not only get up the Copper but also to explore the Tanana and the Koyukuk. So these military explorations were going on. There were professional journalists and professional travel writers coming to try to climb McKinley, to try to climb St. Elias, and Sheldon Jackson was out recruiting missionaries. So all these things were going on before the gold rush even happened. All these different strands of people were starting to come to Alaska, and Gallman write about it.
And it's a fascinating time from many, many standpoints, but the tourism is probably the most fascinating of all. A number of the people that you took excerpts from their writings were all British.
There were. I think of the 27 people in the book, I think 5 or 6 of them are British people, which is amazing. But, you know, people, to come to Alaska took such a commitment of time and funds. You had to have the leisure time. You had to have the money. And so that meant there were a lot of wealthy people doing this, and the British people especially, and this one wonderful guy named Harry DeWitt, who wanted to cross from New York to Paris overland on foot, came through Alaska twice, and both times he was traveling with his manservant Harding.
People right. traveled with an amazing entourage of people uh-huh. and things uh-huh. when they traveled in those days.
Absolutely.
I think you mentioned in one of your stories about some women who actually brought a portable bowling alley with them
mm-hmm.
to Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two New York society women. And they were actually, Terry Cole says that of all the people who went to the Gold Rush, they were the only two out for a summer lark. But they were traveling. They were traveling with. This is a great story because they, of course, you know, it took so long to get to Alaska in those days. If you were coming from the East Coast, you crossed the country by train. You got on a boat on the West Coast, and then depending on where you were going, you had another 1,000 miles to go at the rate of 15 miles an hour. So these women come with this huge entourage. When they get to San Francisco, they decide their maid is too young and pretty to take with them to the Klondike, so they leave her behind. But with them, they bring these packing cases with silk stockings and china and linen and pate and silver and oysters and asparagus. They had their mandolin and their zither and their ice cream freezer, a library, steamer chairs, and part of what they had was they were going to Dawson, and their plan was in Dawson that they might be able to make money with a portable bowling alley and the equipment for a movie theater. And they got to Dawson, and there was no building large enough to accommodate the portable bowling alley, and it turned out that their movie theater had come with missing parts, so they didn't have all the equipment for the movie theater. But their story is just rollicking. It's a very funny story.
What did they do now that they were stuck in Dawson with no way to make income?
You know, I have to tell you, I don't think income was really an issue.
Huh.
One of them was the widow of a naval admiral, and the other one was the grandniece of President Van Buren. So these women were fairly well-heeled. In fact, their friends all thought they were crazy. They said, you know, what are you doing going to Alaska? You'll have to leave behind all the luxuries. Well, the truth was they had no intention of sacrificing any of their luxuries. They were bringing them all with them. But they got there, and it's crazy because even though they acquired claims, they never really did any mining themselves. They took a share. You know, they'd take these mm-hmm. lays. They'd fund other miners. But what they did do was they lived in this 2,800-square-foot tent that they brought with them. It was so cold in winter, they had to erect a smaller tent inside to sleep in because it was so cold. Stored all their food down the ground, permafrost, no need for refrigeration. They'd feed all their neighbors. And then they built this huge 2-story log house that they never lived in. And they had to wait. They were desperately trying to get out before the snow flew. Edith Van Buren, who was the author's Mary Hitchcock, and her friend Edith Van Buren said she would die a direful death if she had to spend the winter in Dawson. So they were very anxious to get out, but they couldn't leave until this 2-story log cabin got finished because the plan was to come back the next summer. And, you know, I've never been able to find out if they came back. I don't think they came back the next summer. I think they built this huge log cabin and then left and never came back. It's a story.
It'd be worth going up to see if signs of the log cabin are still
there. It would be.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Pierre Burton probably knows. We could probably find out from him.
Great,
yeah.
Great book on yeah. the Klondike, yes.
Yeah,
M. Clark.
Oh, M. Clark is a wonderful story.
Yeah.
M. Clark wrote a book called Roadhouse Tales. And her book, you can tell, if you read between the lines, you can tell that M. Clark was a woman. But she never says this. And I had, as an aside, I first wrote this book in 83 and 84 when I was living in Anchorage, taking writing classes and freelancing for the Daily News. And I had read this book and couldn't really find a lot about the woman. But when I started reworking the book in 2009, all these wonderful resources were available on the Internet. And so I did a bit of poking around, and I thought, you know, I bet I can find this woman's family, and I did find her family. Hmm. Her granddaughter and great-grandson live outside of Seattle, and I was there last fall and went to visit with them, which was a great deal of fun. And they filled me in the background on her. What had happened was she was married to a Civil War veteran who became ill and had to go to the hospital in Seattle, and she was left with the sole care of three children. And so she went out into the wilderness on the Skagit River and started a roadhouse. And then when the gold rush came along, she got bit with the bug, and she went to Alaska. And she took two of her three children with her. Her claim was jumped. And so what this very resourceful woman did is she adopted the identity of a man. She dropped her name, which is Matilda. She became N. Clark. She packed a gun, and she became a man.
Mm.
Isn't that great?
That's a wonderful tale. Very Shakespeare-esque somehow. The you know, to us adopting the other side for safety or other reasons.
Yeah.
So in the book also you have a number of really great photographs.
Oh,
that kind
good,
of focus on people's faces, which is rare for this period of time. Mm-hmm. So the question is, where'd you get them?
Well, I actually, and I'm glad you mentioned the faces because I love the faces, and one of my great concerns was to try to show the faces because I think you can look at those faces, and even though I don't know the people in those pictures, I just love looking at the faces and trying to think, now, what was this person's story? When I was putting the original manuscript together in the old days, we didn't have the digital collections because, of course, we had no Internet. And I was looking at these albums of microfilm in the University of Alaska Library and picking out those photos from microfilm. Almost, I'd say 99% of the pictures that are in the book came from those original microfilm pictures that I'd selected. And what I had done was written off to the state library, and they would print the photos off for $25 a piece and send them to you. So I had this fat envelope full of pictures that I'd taken home with me with that original drafted manuscript. And when I got the book back out and started working on it again and realized that publication was going to be imminent, I had to get a lot more information so I could do the credits. And there's a wonderful woman at the state library named Sandra Johnson, who I was lucky enough to somehow get hooked up with. And Sandy was just absolutely marvelous because I had scanned the photos and I sent her the scans, and she researched every one of those photos from the little information I had, found the credit line, found the information I needed to be able to properly credit the photos. And it was just terrific. Those are most every photograph in that book comes from the Alaska State Library.
Well, you'll have a chance, to meet some of the staff of the Alaska State Library because that's where your presentation will be. And that is Monday at what time?
It's Monday at noon.
Okay, Monday at noon, or the regular historical book presentation on Monday. And so it'll be wonderful to welcome you to Juneau. We're having a wonderful sunny day right now, and I think the forecast for tomorrow is for some of more of the same. So we'll have some extraordinary Juneau weather for you to experience when you get up here.
I hope so, because I love Juneau. It's one of my favorite places in Alaska. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, outstanding. Jean Moe, the book is In Pursuit of Alaska, an anthology of traveler's tales 1879 to 1909. She will be talking about it and reading some excerpts from probably at noon at the State Library in the historical section.
Can I add one thing, Pat?
Yeah, go right ahead.
The presentation I make is actually not reading from the book. In fact, I've kind of avoided reading from the book. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's a collection of 90 other photographs and maps that aren't in the book. And what I do is illustrate not just the 30 years of Alaska history, but back up and talk a couple of minutes about the first 10,000 years, and then talk a bit about the stories of some of the people in the book. So that's the presentation on Monday.
Well, Jean, it sounds like a fascinating presentation. I hope a lot of people show up for it.
Thank you, Pat, and thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay, great.
Hey, Katie, what's that sound?
That's the sound of America getting ready for the greatest event of the summer.
Oh, what? Is FizzFest 2013 happening?
You betcha.
Ooh, tell me more. What's the deets?
This year, Scorcher is kicking off the party at 9 p.m. with the coolest Rocksteady Jams. There will be food provided by the Twisted Fish, and of course, adult beverages aplenty, because it's a 21 and over event.
That sounds amazing.
And that's not all. DJs Astronomar and Shorthand will be spinning the hottest dance tracks ever.
But wait, won't it sound more like this?
Aw, yeah. Let's celebrate our freedom on July 3rd at the Twisted Fish at 9 p.m. for FishFest 2013.
20 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is the guy who's responsible for planting the biggest crane I think I've ever seen in the middle of downtown Juneau, right behind the studio here. Hi, Bob Banghart.
How you doing?
You're deputy director of the museum, and you have been kind of tagged into being the coordinator of this huge project to rebuild the that they call the SLAM, the State Library, Archives, and Museum, to combine all together, right?
But one of a number of people that are working on it. Yeah, no, it's
so this is going to mean some big changes.
Yes and no. I mean, we still have a state library, a state archive, and state museum. They'll be amalgamated in a new building. They'll be increasing their capacity for collections by a factor of 2 to 3. We'll increase our exhibit space downstairs about 2.5 times. We're adding a flat floor auditorium, if you will, you know, place to do lectures and presentations, and just a whole number of elements that add to what this building is, which is a 100-year facility in regard to how it's being designed and built. So the future is looking pretty good. We got 2 well-equipped state-of-the-art conservation labs, one for paper and one for objects. We'll be doing all of this in a new building envelope that will be effectively doubling our size as a division, essentially cutting our current operating costs for the facility size as we are now. And that's because we're using saltwater cooling cycles. We've got 3 saltwater wells. We're using advanced building envelope technology. The exterior of the building actually is being built in Fairbanks. Which is kind of cool. This project and one other one spawned a new business for Bucher Glass. So there's a 32,000 square foot production facility making the exterior curtain wall construction panels for us up there. So that's pretty cool. 20 guys going to work.
So is that, what are we seeing going up right now that the crane is moving into place? It looks like whole walls.
Those are forms.
Okay.
This is the collection vault, which is the core of the building. That's the most important aspect. It's a completely concrete cast enclosure, both floors, first and second. First floor is museum collections at about 6 to 7 feet above current grade, and second floor is historical collections and archives. Now, that's a complete cast concrete building, this particular phase. That then is covered on the outside with this new building curtain wall, which is aluminum framework with a vitrified ceramic tile and insulation and other things. So we end up with the ability to completely waterproof the concrete and then add a watertight second skin. So that gives us about as best a protection as you can get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Not only does it provide us for wind and moisture proofness, it also gives us a very stable environment in which to heat and cool so we don't have rapid fluctuations, which is the big danger of poorly constructed buildings and the hardest on collections. So it's going to be both instances we're adding capacity to collect over the next 30, 40 years too. So that's good.
What's the timetable look like?
Timetable? Right now we are we had a project meeting last week, and as of July 12th, this coming July 12th, the project will be 100% on schedule and on budget, and we'll move forward with the collection vault, which is the first phase.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be closing the museum February 28th, and we will be then removing the collections through its specially designed tunnel. It's basically 2 connexes welded together. And we'll be emptying the building into the new collections vault. So we're moving from finished secure storage to finished secure storage.
Mm-hmm.
So once the museum is empty, which will take us about 6 weeks, to get the objects relocated and the staff relocated to the archives building and to the state office building. We will then tender the building to the demolition contractor, and the existing building,
mm-hmm.
and then they will begin the process of a systematic deconstruction, encapsulate it. They'll pull the panels off and then take the building apart. Then the contractor will move in and start the second phase, which would be to construct the exhibition areas, the administrative and lab spaces and staff workspaces. And that runs through, so you have the building coming down in May of next year, a little less than a year, about less than a year from now. And then they'll be in full steam construction up until anticipated what they call the turnover time, which when the, us as owners or tenants, if you will, take ownership of the building in January of 2016. And then we'll be in a series of months where we'll be building out the exhibits to final and moving all the collections for the second floor and all the staffing in and getting set up. So it'll be, you know, certain segments of the building will be open to the public at certain times, but we're looking for full-on dedication of the facility in its entirety sometime in April, May of 2016.
Your whole staff's going over to the state office building?
We'll put some of them at the put collection staff at the archives and put the exhibit staff and the visitor services and at state office building and just tuck people away.
Yeah. You came on board as the curator of collections.
Curator of exhibitions.
Exhibitions. Yeah. And I was wondering if you had an inkling that this was going to happen to you when you said yes to the job offer.
No, not really. I knew that the building was, back in 95, I was a volunteer at the museum with the Friends, and we were working to secure, to purchase the property. And so I knew that the property was, you know, in the bank, and I'd seen plans and heard talk forever living here and being in the business. And, but I took the position of exhibits curator, and then, opportunity came up to be chief curator, about 2 years into that. So I took that on, and then, last August officially took over as the deputy director of the division. And it's just been a, you know, I would say, I'd be lying if I said it was done by design. That's not the case. It's just been an opportunity that has afforded itself, and it's great. It's absolutely great.
Well, like a lot of projects that go on that are this large, you actually are sort of funding as you go in many to some extent. You have some things locked up, but a few things still not funded?
Well, we essentially got a base price on the building, and which was $130 million. And to date, we've got a little over $100 million in the bank, and we're working off of that. And early on, we were able to, because it was what's called a CMGC, Construction Managed General Contractor type project, where 20% of the design documents, we bring the general contractor selection into play, get them on board, and they provide the service of verifying buildability and also help to maintain economic costing. Architects might want to go in a direction that might, you know, have economic ramifications of the project we're not really ready to absorb. So it kind of puts the third leg on the stool to keep a checks and balances on extrapolated budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, we negotiated what's called a guaranteed maximum price, or GMP. And if we were able to reach a certain level of funding by July 31st of this year, we would have that price locked in for the duration of the project. That doesn't look like we're going to make that mark, so we'll be looking to, you know, we'll be subjugated to being responsive to price escalations, commodity costs, those kinds of natural inflation costs that a building project might incur, because it's a three-and-a-half-year project. But our projections are good. You know, prices are staying pretty stable. We're not seeing any wild fluctuations, so we're optimistic we can still, you know, we'll see some increase, but not anything that's going to cripple us. And we've had great support from the legislature and especially the governor, and we hope to continue that dynamic in the relationship over the next year or so. And our delegation has been pushing hard, and the city's been pushing hard. So people recognize the value, they recognize the importance, and we have, I think, have had really good support across the board in that respect. So I'm optimistic, you know, we'll get there.
So in 2016, when the whole thing is all done and they hand you the keys and all that sort of stuff, what will the experience of the museum be like for us?
Well, you'll walk in the main door, which will be facing east, very similar in location and placement that it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Bear in mind, the new building is 180,000 square feet aggregate. That includes the parking space, which is 60-some spots. Our current building is around 24,000, so it's considerably larger. People are seeing right now it's just the first floor of the vaults. It goes up that size again, plus a little bit.
Hmm.
So you'll walk into the lobby space. And that'll go from ground floor entry all the way to the ceiling of the building in the center section, some 40-some feet. That'll be a long corridor. That floor will be a terrazzo floor with an inlaid map of the state of Alaska oriented true north with Canada and Russia on there, with the longitude lines in place. So that'll help you establish place. To the left immediately when you walk in will be the museum. First you'll encounter the store, then the museum store. Then you'll encounter the entry to the museum. And then there is occupying the bulk of the south side of the building, ground floor. We'll have two major changing galleries and one smaller changing gallery and a whole complement of permanent exhibits in that area. And on the immediate right when you walk in, there'll be a small cafe. And then next to that will be a set of stair and elevator and locker. Next to that will be entrance to the multi-purpose room, flat floor presentation area that has a small production booth in it for, you know, monitoring audio and video. And that'll be acoustically tuned. Then as you work your way back in the building, you'll hit the main staircase going upstairs. It will be very similar to what we have now. It will wind its way up through the mezzanine area to the second floor. And in the center of that stair cavity will be a new Eagle Tree.
Huh.
And so once you get to the mezzanine, we'll stay in the public areas. The mezzanine area bleeds out onto an area where there'll be six large display cases that we've got in play that will be something that the public, the community, can get access to on a short time frame. You know, when we schedule shows in the building and the normal galleries, that's a long, you know, a couple of years in advance.
Yeah.
Here we'll be able to take advantage of programs that are popping up, turn it over to the community to actually do the install, those kinds of things. So that's on the mezzanine, and then you wind your way up to the second floor, and then you come to a bridge that will go from the second floor administrative area, or termination for the stairway, over into the library, which is then, as you work your way back from the public space of the library, there's a research room, there's a processing room for the staffing, then you're into the collections again. But that's back of house. But downstairs, you'll be able to be involved with the lobby, the museum, and other attendant spaces. There'll be a classroom that'll be public access. Once you go through a set of doors, then you're going to be into the laboratories, the conservation laboratories. Then you're into collection space and workshop space.
Bob, you've got this, I see that you have this image wonderfully in your head. So I think you're the guy to be directing the distance from here to 2016 when the museum is fully open and working like a champ. Thank you so much for doing all this heavy work here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. You bet.
And thanks for bringing us an interesting crane in the middle of town, too. It's kind of fun to watch.
Absolutely.
Okay. Hey, good luck with the rest of the project.
Thanks a lot.
So sweet, so I turned myself to face me. But I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change and face the strain.
Change
don't
wanna be a richer man.
Certainly big changes coming to the Alaska Museum and Archives as the crane rolls back and forth and moves walls into place. And a small change to our weather, not too much. We're looking like mostly cloudy for the rest of today, although it certainly is sunny out my window right now. And we are looking at some isolated showers tonight. The highs should be about where they are now, about 67, and a little southwest winds, 10 miles per hour. Then tonight it's going to cloud up a little bit. We'll have some isolated showers this evening. Those lows will go down to probably around 50, northwest winds 5 miles per hour. And then Saturday we'll have partly cloudy with the highs around 71, northwest winds 5 miles per hour, shifting over to the southeast in the afternoon. Isolated showers again on Saturday night. So nice, typical Juneau weather, I guess, is how we'll put that. Okay. Here's Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 28th of June, 2013. It's the birthday of philosopher and writer Jean-Jacques Rousseau, born in Geneva on this day in 1712. In 1749, the Academy of Dijon sponsored an essay contest, and the question was, has the revival of the arts and sciences done more to corrupt or to purify morals? Rousseau was delighted by the question, and he said that his head was so full of ideas he was unable to breathe. He said, "And that is how I became a writer, almost against my will. The remainder of my life and all my subsequent misfortunes were the inevitable result of this moment of aberration." Rousseau was normally a lazy fellow, but he worked feverishly on his essay, A Discourse on the Sciences and Arts, and it won first prize. He went on to write many more philosophical works, including his famous The Social Contract, in which he said that the natural condition of humanity is to be brutal and lawless, and that it is through an agreed social contract of what constitutes a good society that humans are able to rise above their base nature. It's the birthday of comedian and filmmaker Mel Brooks, born Melvin Kaminsky in Brooklyn in 1929. In the Army in World War II, he deactivated mines after the Battle of the Bulge while he was organizing shows for his fellow servicemen. In 1949, his friend Sid Caesar asked him to write for his comedy program, Your Show of Shows, and later he wrote his first feature film, The Producers. The movie didn't do well at the box office, but it was made into a Broadway musical and won 15 Tony Awards. Mel Brooks, who said, "Tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you walk into an open sewer and die." It was on this day in 1948 that Shirley Jackson's controversial short story, The Lottery, was published in The New Yorker. Hundreds of readers wrote to the magazine, many of them wanting to cancel their subscriptions because they were so upset by the story, which ends with people in a small village stoning one of their citizens. Jackson later wrote, "On the morning of June 28, 1948, I walked down to the post office in our little Vermont town to pick up the mail. I was quite casual about it, as I recall. I opened the box, took out a couple of bills and a letter or two, talked to the postmaster for a few minutes, and left, never supposing that it was the last time for months that I was to pick up the mail without an active feeling of panic. By the next week, I had to change my mailbox to the largest one in the post office, and casual conversation with the postmaster was out of the question because he wasn't speaking to me." And here's a poem by Seamus Heaney, Fireside. Always there would be stories of lights hovering among bushes or at the foot of a meadow, maybe a goat with cold horns pluming into the moon, a tingle of chains on the midnight road, and then maybe word would come round of that watery art, the lamping of fishes, and I'd be mooning my flash lamp on the licked black pelt of the stream, my left arm splayed to take a heavy pour and run of the current, occluding the net. Was that the beam buckling over an eddy, or a gleam of the fabulous? Steady the light and come to your senses. They're saying good night." A poem by Seamus Heaney, Fireside, from Selected Poems, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
It's about 20 minutes to 4. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Safran Hayes is here with me, and Safran has just finished a really interesting project that we're all going to get to see a look at here on the 20th and 21st of July, and then again on the 27th and 28th of July. Safran spent a good part of 2004 traveling around in Alaska, Nepal, and India, and he assembled his travelogue or travel record as a film and is going to be showing it to us at the Gold Town Theater. Safran, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, why did you decide to do this? What was the motivation?
I felt the need right out of high school to submerge myself in another culture. It's very strange, you know. I'm not sure how many young adults feel the same way when they get out of school, but I just felt I really needed to go see a different part of the world and just see how other societies just interact with the physical world and just to see a different culture than what I was used to.
So when you said, Mom, Dad, by the way, thanks for getting me through high school and I'm taking off tomorrow for Nepal, was there a shocked silence? Or?
Yes, yeah, there was. My mother was very worried. I was going there with a friend, a family friend, and so that really helped get me over there. But then I kind of left, and I remember telling my mom, I'm going to go off on my own now that I'm in India. And she really started freaking out.
So at what point in this world tour did you realize that the camera you had in your hand recording things was actually moving you toward making a film of the whole deal, or did you go with the idea of doing that?
I always wanted to really make a documentary film, and I went there with that in mind, but I never knew exactly how I was gonna, you know, how the story was gonna end up unfolding. But I really wanted to try and capture the experience of just being there in the moment with the camera, and just the experiences that I was able to capture, and just the, you know, overcoming the problems and the fears of traveling, and to just capture the the American youth, how they kind of interact with a just completely different culture.
So now you were shooting the footage, or did you have someone else doing the camera?
Yeah, I shot the footage all myself, and I did all the editing. And
so then, did you narrate as you shot? Were you mic'd up and talking about what you were seeing?
No, it was I did all the narration afterwards. So yeah, I just I was just really trying to capture whatever really interested me and whatever was I found intriguing, you know, from where I have grown up here in Juneau, and I'm hoping to show that to my peers and friends back home. And it's been a bit of a you could say like a spiritual a journey, or just kind of this trying to capture this bigger awareness of the greater picture.
And do you feel like you found that?
I do, yeah. And I'm hoping that the audience will see that too when they come see the film.
I guess the other question I have is kind of technical, and that is you had to carry gear with you wherever you went. And I'm wondering, first of all, what you were carrying. I mean, what did you take in order to record the footage?
Well, I took pretty much what I would take here in Alaska. I just had a backpack and, you know, a Therm-a-Rest, a sleeping bag, and a tent, and a camera and, you know, some a little bit of money. And
so no real specialized video gear or anything like that?
No. You know, I guess kind of the typical backcountry gear for around here, but maybe not the typical tourist gear that you normally see an American in India.
How did people react to you wanting to film everything or record everything with your camera as it was happening?
The people in India loved it, and I have some really just amazing video. I would turn the LCD, the camera around so that the children could see themselves on the camera, and I got some really amazing facial expressions, and just people were really excited to be on camera, and I never had any kind of negativity or anyone being upset with me.
You say this was in India. Was it different in Nepal?
And in Nepal, yeah. And there's a lot of political turmoil in Nepal, and so there's sometimes, you know, I would. You know, really be cautious about pulling the camera out, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for the most part, I didn't have any problems. You know, I carried the camera around in an orange Pelican case, and it was bright orange. And so that actually got the most comments of, what's in that case?
Mm-hmm. Perfectly good reason to open it up, take it out, and start shooting pictures.
Yeah.
Then you did most of this travel in 2004, and then there's this long period of gestation and editing and everything else that's always involved in any film. In your case, it's about 9 years, and you said you took some breaks along that way. But I guess the question I have is, after you got to the point where you had edited and edited and edited, when did you know it was done?
Well, you know, it took me a long time. After I got back, I wasn't very happy with how it had turned out, and what I wanted to try and pass on to the viewers is the sense of kind of overcoming personal fears and kind of learning to believe in yourself and to build this awareness of the greater picture of kind of our relationship with the world. And that was really hard to do from this kind of narrative, you know, view of just kind of my experience. And I wanted to go farther than that. And so it took a lot of contemplation. And actually, where I end the film is my experiences after I come back from the trip and kind of my culture shock, as you will. And I reenact a scene of taking off, leaving town and kind of going off by myself after I get home and kind of going through this near-death experience and in a kayak and flipping the kayak and having to swim to shore and then just this living off the land for a few days. And so that's and finishing it that way, I felt was a really powerful way of kind of bringing this learning how to believe in yourself and to building this awareness of the world.
Safran, we're going to get a chance to see how that all came together. The Gold Town Theater is showing the film on the 20th of July from 9 to 10 at night, and then on the 21st it repeats in the afternoon from 2:30 to 3:30, and then the same show schedule on the 27th and the 28th, all at the Gold Town Theater. Well, I wish you great luck in whatever your next project is. Did we get even a slight inkling of what you're up to now?
Yeah, so I'm starting up a production company, Manifest Reality Productions, and the second project I'm going to be working on is an animation called BioArc. And I've already started the animation, and it's as a completely different kind of movie, but as same kind of genre, if you will, kind of about global awareness and coming together. And so I'm really excited about that. And I've been working with my cousins in Wrangell who are working. They're starting up a company called Fringe Games, and they just recently started building a game called War Command, which is a card game, and they've been doing a lot of, they're trying to get this card game into a iOS format for Android and cell mm-hmm. phones. And so I've been working with them to create a lot of 3D animations and just elaborate story, science fiction, fantasy. And it's been really cool. You know, one of the really interesting aspects of growing up in Alaska, you know, my cousins, they've gone fishing most of their lives. And their father is a longshore fisherman. And so we get this really interesting aspect of kind of how people interact with the land, and it's really cool to see it kind of play out in the artwork and the digital realm that we live in today.
Great. Saffron Hayes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is I, former President George W. Bush, and as you know, I've been laying low since I left the White House, just doing watercolors of dogs and giving myself time for refraction. But it's hard to hold my tongue when the current administration is besieged by scandal.
When IRS guys are smiling,
at least they'll be able to listen to the Capitol Steps. 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday on this public radio station.
Wednesday, July 3rd at 3 o'clock on KTOO News.
This is Bird Note. Around this time of year, many baby birds are begging their parents for food. Let's eavesdrop on a few. That's a hairy woodpecker chick in its nest cavity deep within a dying tree. Now these are red-breasted sapsucker chicks calling from their nest. As adults, sapsuckers are usually pretty quiet. Let's move from forest to water to hear an American coot chick and its parent. Listen for the call of the adult. Buck, buck. This next one? That's a Sora chick. Hidden among the reeds in a marsh. Nestlings and fledglings, lucky enough to survive the perils of youth, become juveniles. If you're lucky, come July or August, you could be startled by this sound in the night. That's a great horned owl juvenile reminding its parents, "Hey, I'm over here, feed me." The parents are ignoring these entreaties. They've done their job. It's time for the young owl to feed itself. No, no, feed me! Today's sounds were recorded by talented, intrepid audio recordists and provided by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You know, it's not every day that I have a bagpipe as background music. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a seat there so we can also hear you talk as well as play the bagpipe. So the bagpipist was bagpiper, Laurie Gardner, and she's the pipe sergeant and dance teacher for the City of Juneau Pipe Band and Highland Dancers. And with her is Margot Oliver, who is one of the young dancers. Hi, Margot. So, and I also have in the studio with me Rhonda Jackson-Bear and Rachel. So these are two performers who are also going to be seen in about, 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes, I think. This is Food Truck Friday over at the Jack. So.
Yep, I think we're starting at 6:30.
Yes, actually, we're the last show.
So you're the last show. So I think it opens up at about 5:30, and
yes.
this is our new thing. And now, is somebody also performing out at the airport?
That's a separate type of venue,
and
I don't believe it's happening tonight.
Okay, I know. It's actually on Sunday, I believe. That's the Music on the Fly.
Yeah, I'm signed up for
and
that.
And you're signed
later.
Up. You're doing that on Sunday night.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That's our new
Sunday.
Yeah, yeah. So that's our new startling thing for the air traveler to suddenly notice that it's possible to have music, real live music, in an airport. So, and Margot, are you going to go out and dance at the airport?
I really don't know.
You don't know. Well, we'll see if that happens. I can see you kind of, you know, doing a good Scottish dance down along the TSA line while she marches back and forth with the
pipes. Absolutely. If she's available, I'm going to have her down there.
I think that'll work real well. So, Rhonda and Rachel, what are you all doing at 6:30 tonight?
We're just going to do a short acoustic set of some alternative type music.
Okay.
So Rhonda's a singer. I play guitar and I sing also.
Okay.
And we'll have another lead guitar player with us.
So it's a three-person act, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is a really interesting deal because basically we bring out food trucks and different folks who are cooking up great meals, and you can wander around and get a plate of food, and then there's entertainment all the time that it's going on as well.
Exactly.
So both of you will be performing over at the Jack tonight.
Yes, we're on 5:30 to 6:30, and this group will follow us.
Uh huh.
We like to be first so we don't interrupt while we're tuning up.
So this is not just you. It's the whole...
Our whole City of Juneau Pipe Band,
yeah. Wow.
And a number of our dancers. Yes.
Yeah. So that's always a great show when it happens.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and Margot, how long have you been dancing this
style? I've been dancing for about 4 years. We started, the whole group of us started when we were about 5. And we've just kept on doing it. A couple people have dropped out, but we've just kept on doing it.
Are you Scottish?
A little bit.
A little bit. A tiny little bit. Okay. Well,
you're supposed to say a wee bit.
Well, Food Truck Friday is the latest iteration of what the Jack is doing to try to provide entertainment to the community. These were the concerts that were over in the Marine Park, but I think it's a much better venue because we can do it indoors, or on a lovely day like this we can move it outdoors unless we get these isolated showers that they're forecasting and like that. So it's a real opportunity to come down and take part in the entertainment as well as take advantage of some good food. So when you play out at the airport now, that's got to be a real interesting venue because there you are with all of this gear and equipment and everything like that, and the folks who are wandering by are probably looking at you with a kind of a quizzical expression on their face wondering just why a pipe band is in the middle of the airport.
Well, it's going to be a solo. It can be very loud indoors if we are in mass, so I'll either play the small pipes or the great Highland pipes, depending on how full the terminal is.
The small pipes or the great Highland pipes.
The ones,
so those of us who are not technically bagpipe proficient, can you make the distinction?
The pipes that I've started the program with, those are the small pipes.
Okay.
And much mellower, sweet sound. And then the great Highland pipes are the ones that go up over your shoulder, and the volume is pretty amazing.
I know.
Yeah.
I once was in a concert where I had to sing with pipes, and I'm telling you right now, blending with pipes can be a challenge. Do you use pipes in your act?
Not yet.
Just your own, right?
Yep.
Well, yeah, primarily Rhonda's, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Rachel also does some singing as well.
Yeah, so the two of you work together. Yeah,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, what kind of, you said alternatives, so give me a for instance, what kind of stuff are you going to do?
We're doing a Red Hot Chili Peppers cover called Don't Forget Me.
Okay.
So that's kind of our feel, you know. The acoustics that we put together is kind of just a warm introduction of what we're doing. We're still pretty new together, so we've only rehearsed a handful of times, so we're kind of new to performing right now.
Well, I wish you very good luck with this venue. I think it's a real opportunity for us to catch some great acts and to eat some good food in the process.
Definitely.
Okay. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we're also on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also hear us on GCI Cable. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN is on digital channel 872. And KXLL is on 873. And we're also online 24/7 at www.ktoo.org. Monday at 3 on KTOFM, Juneau Afternoon, Joan Pardis is the host, and she'll be talking about the 4th of July activities in Juneau and Douglas. Bob Beath will drop by. He's highlighting a new science camp for JEDC. And Kayfield Parker will talk about her upcoming First Friday presentation at the State Museum. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more Monday at 3 on Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Great pleasure talking to all these people and helping you find out what's going on in Juneau. I'll see you next Friday. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.